area. They handle interior and exterior signs, from stop signs to plaza markers. They also handle banners, truck lettering, neon signs, monument signs, ADA signage, and trade show displays. At Deptford Signorama, their motto is, "Our signs sell your business or product 24/7. They also give great service with a personal touch. The phone number for Deptford Signorama.
Hi, this is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio Show, and we have an amazing show tonight. We're going to start off with Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, the socialist senator, the populist senator. Going to follow that with Joe Sestak. He'll be coming right off of the Rachel Maddow Show to do 15 minutes with us. Then we're going to do the last half hour of the show with Scott Horton. Scott Horton is a writer for Harper's Magazine. He's an attorney. He's on top of the issues of torture and justice and civil rights. And there's really interesting, exciting information. The interview with Bernie Sanders and Scott Horton is already in the can, just done the last day or two. And Joe Sestak's going to be live with us. So why don't we switch right over to the interview with Bernie Sanders. You got that, Karen?
Hi, great to have you with us.
Hold on just a second, let me get one phone call.
Hi, this is Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good to hear your voice again.
Good, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I love the new legislation you're introducing.
You like the two-bag-to-fill?
Well, we talked about it a little over a year ago, the idea about too-big-to-fail, and now you're moving ahead and doing something to bring the Giants down. It's fabulous.
Good. All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate your support for that.
Yeah. So what's the response to it in the Senate?
Well, we just introduced it as soon as I left. So at this moment, there's momentum for it, not only in the Senate, but there's momentum for it from people like Paul Volcker from the United Kingdom, from this fellow who is the CEO, former CEO of Citigroup, who has now apologized for the mergers and for his role in trying to bring about deregulation. And I think there is an understanding that it is basically insane, underlying the word insane, that we have bailed out to the tune of $700 billion plus trillions in zero-interest loans, institutions that were too big to fail over a year ago. You know what? Many of them are even bigger right now.
It is insane. So how will it work? How do you envision breaking them apart?
Well, we're going to leave that to the Treasury Department. That's what they're paid to do. But what the legislation says, it's a two-page piece of legislation, which is very simple. What it says is, number one, within the first 3 months, you will determine which institutions are too big to fail, i.e., if they go down, they bring systemic damage to the entire economy. Tell us who they are. And then you got 9 months to break them up. And again, as you know, this is now beginning to take place in the United Kingdom.
That is happening there?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll send you a copy of the speech that I gave on the floor show. The United Kingdom is beginning to do this. Paul Volcker is in favor of this. Even Alan Greenspan was saying something about things being too big. Yeah, we'll send you the speech, but if ever, hold on for 1 second. All right, let me just get some paper here. Hold on.
Oh. Breaking up the biggest, like David and Goliath here. And,
Hi, sorry. All right, so you've got a number of folks who are talking about this. You got
While you're looking, let me say something. You know, I call my radio show the Bottom Up Radio Show, and after seeing the news about your legislation, it got me thinking that big is top down, small is bottom up.
Right.
And small is seems like it would be a better thing for so many aspects of our economy, in terms of diversity and media consolidation. I mean, I hope you're going to be looking at this in terms of media as well, this legislation.
Well, right now, I am and I have, but I think the main point right now that we're focusing on is financial institutions. And the point, consistent with what you've just said, is that right now, according to the Washington Post, the four largest banks in America, and that's Bank of America, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup, now issue one out of every two mortgages. Got that?
Yep.
Two out of every three credit cards. And they hold four out of every $10 in bank deposits in the entire country, 40% of the bank deposits. So you have an institution, you have a situation where it's not only the issue of too big to fail and our need not to have to bail these guys out anymore, but with interest rates at some of these banks at 25 or 30%, without the competition that you need, they're getting away with murder in terms of their high interest rates, the fees that they're charging, et cetera. And then on top of that, despite the bailout, they are not lending to the productive economy so that we can get the kind of jobs that we need. And then furthermore, these people have so much money that when some folks say, well, you know what, it should be Congress that regulates these big institutions, the truth is these institutions are regulating Congress. They are so powerful and so big, and they have so much money that, you know, the whole deregulation effort ended up with the financial institutions spending $5 billion over a 10-year period in order to get deregulation. So, you know, I think you got to break them up for just a large number of reasons.
So we agree small is better for big business. How would you respond to a GOP right-winger Republican saying that small is better for government, too, and big government is not good?
Well, it depends on what you mean by quote-unquote big government. If they're talking about a military budget that is probably too large, I would agree with them. If they're talking about big government giving all kinds of corporate welfare, I would agree with them. But if the issue is, do I think that every American is entitled to health care as a right of citizenship, and there's something wrong, that the United States remains the only country in the world, in the industrialized world, that does not provide health care to all people, now, I think the government should be doing that. I think the government should be playing an active role in making sure that our people have a decent standard of living, that we create the kind of jobs that we need, people have the educational opportunity that we need, we have the infrastructure that we need. Of course, we have got to do those things. And, that would be my response.
Okay. Well, right. What do you think about what's happening with the Senate? What's going to happen in the Senate now with the health care? I wrote an article today. I can't imagine the first pass of the Senate bill having a public option.
I'm not gonna speculate. I don't know what will happen, nor does anybody else. But all I can tell you is that I'm going to do my best to come up not only with a public option, but a strong public option. And not only a strong public option, a strong public option that is available to tens of millions of Americans so they can have a choice as to whether they want a private or a public insurance program. And without a strong, widely used public option, you're not going to have the kind of cost containment that you need, in my view, in keeping the private insurance companies honest. So I think you've got to do that. I think we've got to focus on affordability. Look, the goal here, let's be clear, it's not just passing a piece of legislation. The goal is passing a strong piece of legislation which is cost-effective, that works for the middle class and working families of this country. So it's not just passing anything. It's passing something that is meaningful. And that's what I'm going to fight for.
What about the state level? It looks like the House passed a bill that doesn't give any help to the states to allow any efforts at the state level, and that's how Canada got their nationalized health insurance.
We are working just on that issue right now.
Yeah, would you vote for something that didn't happen?
I'm not going to tell you. So I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to vote for or what I'm not going to vote for, because there is no bill. I can't speculate. But the idea of giving...
One last question.
Yeah.
With Lieberman threatening to filibuster if the public option is in, if a first draft went forward without a public option and then it went into conference where it was added back, can it be filibustered again once it goes into conference?
What you need at the end, yes. You need what you could do is what they could do is filibuster the conferees. You would need 60 votes to go into conference, yes.
So once it gets into conference, it can't be filibustered?
Once it gets into conference, I think that there are ways. If your question is it going to take 60 votes to pass this thing, the answer is it will take 60 votes, because there are always ways that you could slow up this place. So the answer is it's going to take 60 votes. There's no way that I have. That is fine.
Well,
unless you go to reconciliation, and then you can deal with parts of it.
Right.
All right.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. You take care. Keep up the good work.
Warrior, keep it going. Thank you.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. WNJ.
I'm on live now. I'm on. Okay. So there's been a new announcement. President Obama has said he's not going to deal with any of the four suggestions regarding Afghanistan, and we don't know what's going to happen yet, but we do know this. Joe Sestak's delayed because he's going to be on Rachel Maddow, and he's going to be coming from her to us. So what we're going to do is we're going to play the Scott Horton interview now, and Joe Sestak will be on at around 9:45. So, Karen, go directly now to the Scott Horton interview. Can you do that?
Well, welcome to the Rob Bottom-Up Radio Show, sponsored by OpEdNews.com, and great to have you here. The last time we spoke was face-to-face at Princeton when you were on that panel. Do you remember?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I speak at Princeton about two or three times a year, so I'm not quite sure which one, but I think it was at the panel talking about
Guantanamo.
Right? I
believe that was in March. Well, it's good to have you here now, and now we're going to talk about what's happened in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
A whole big batch of CIA agents were convicted by an Italian prosecutor, and could you talk a little bit about what happened and your take on it?
Absolutely. What happened is, I think just to put it in context, under George W. Bush, the CIA commenced a program that was known as Extraordinary Renditions. And under this program, they would snatch terrorism suspects off the street of cities overseas. They'd cart them off to special CIA-run prisons called black sites, or they would put them into the hands of cooperating foreign governments where they would be regularly and systematically tortured and interrogated for intelligence purposes. We don't know how many people were caught up in the system. Best estimates are it's somewhere between 100 and 150. So this is about one of those cases from 2003, involving an Egyptian cleric who goes by the name of Abu Omar. And he was targeted by the CIA, evidently not because he was believed to be an important terrorist figure, because he clearly wasn't, but because the CIA felt it could turn him into an informant and get him to spy on terrorist cells that they believed he would get access to. So he had gotten asylum in Italy. He was living in Milan with his wife. A team of more than 20 CIA agents were dispatched to Italy to scope him out, to check his daily habits, where he walked, where he went, and then ultimately to kidnap him. So in 2003, the kidnap plan was executed. He was snatched. He was then taken by car to Aviano Air Base, a U.S. Air Force base that's outside of Venice. And from there, he was flown to Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. And from there, he was flown to Egypt, where he was turned over to Egyptian intelligence, and he was tortured quite brutally for a year. In fact, the torture was so severe that when he was released, he wasn't even able to walk without a cane, and he's still suffering from that today. But the Italians, getting a sense of the kidnapping having occurred, opened a criminal investigation into it, and of course they viewed it as simply as a kidnapping and assault. And very early on in the case, they got evidence clearly showing that this had been a CIA operation. But rather than shut it down, they pursued it as a criminal investigation, and they very quickly gathered data about how it was collected. They tracked down all the CIA agents who'd been involved. They traced all their movements. And they did this largely with credit card records and cell phone communications. And in fact, it was quite interesting because what they discovered was that this cohort of CIA agents had been living in Italy for a period of about a month and living very high off the hog. They were having a grand vacation time, staying in five-star hotels, renting luxury automobiles, eating fancy meals, at well-known restaurants, ordering vintage wine, all at the expense of U.S. taxpayers, and also behaving in a way that was quite open, so it was easy to track them down. So the prosecutions were brought, the trial was held, and it produced convictions. But none of the Americans were in the courtroom, and why is that? That's because quite early on, as the case was being developed, the U.S. got wind of the criminal prosecution and the fact that the targets had been identified, and it sent messages to all of them advising them to flee the country immediately because they risked being arrested, which is why they have been for several years quite literally fugitives from justice, and now, of course, they're convicted felons and fugitives from justice.
So this is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio, WNJC 1360, talking to legal expert Scott Horton, who writes a column for Harper's Magazine, and we're talking about how almost two dozen American CIA agents were convicted of engaging in crime, which was rendition, basically kidnapping an Egyptian, taking him to Egypt, keeping him there imprisoned for 4 years, torturing him, or having the Egyptians torture him, and then ultimately he was released with no charges at all. I mean, this is a horrible story. This is not just torturing somebody to prevent a ticking bomb. This is torturing somebody to get them to become a spy, right?
That's exactly right. It was to flip him, and another thing I should say is that the Italians had been attempting to develop a criminal case against Abu Omar. Although they never succeeded in doing it, but he had been under careful surveillance by the Italian criminal police, counterterrorism police, for quite some time, which is another reason they were able to track all of this. The Italian criminal investigation was frustrated by the Americans snatching him.
So, and from you just said that the Italians were able to get the evidence against the American CIA agents because of credit card records and things like that. So basically, these were really sloppy spies doing an incompetent job, leaving a blazing trail, right?
That's right. I mean, Milt Bearden, you know, very former senior CIA operative, in an interview described them as the Keystone Cops. But I think to be a little bit more charitable, look, they felt that they were operating in safe territory, home territory, operating inside Italy, close ally, supporting the United States very, very closely in the war against terror, participating in the operations both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. They didn't think they were going to have any problems with the government. And I think what they forgot is that, well, the difference was that the Italians actually enforced the criminal law, whereas the United
States... Apparently they didn't have problems with the government. They had problems with the prosecutors because the government didn't back up the prosecutors, right? I mean, the government didn't enforce the call to what do you call it when you bring back somebody from another country?
Extradition.
Extradition, yeah. I'm mixing extradition with rendition. But the government...
One is legal.
Yeah, really. Not.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that's a big difference between the Italian system and our system. That is that the prosecutors in Italy and in Spain and a few other countries are completely independent of the political system. In the United States, they're not. In fact, prosecutors in the United States are politically directed, which is one reason why we saw no prosecution of the torture lawyers, for instance, or haven't to date. It's because of this political manipulation and domination of the prosecutorial core. They all answer to the Attorney General, the political appointee. In Italy, that's not the case. There are professional prosecutors who go through a civil service system, and they're completely insulated from political process. And the courts also are completely independent. I think one thing that comes out of this case is a demonstration that, frankly, criminal courts in Italy operate with much greater independence of the government than they do in the United States. We pride ourselves on having an independent judiciary, but I'd say that's increasingly suspect.
Well, that's a different conversation I really want to have as part of this interview today with you. I wanted to kind of move from, you know, the specifics of what's happened in Italy to how does allow this to happen. Basically, the U.S. government has to protect these agents, or they didn't actually. The Italian government did it for them, I imagine. The U.S. government did it in that it warned them to leave to become fugitives.
That's right. And the U.S. government also asserted immunities on their behalf. So the U.S. government hired lawyers in the trial in Italy. And argued that some of these people had diplomatic immunity, and it succeeded because there were 26 people who were charged, but only 23 were convicted. And the three other cases that included Jeffrey Castelli, who was the CIA station chief in Rome, the court agreed that they had diplomatic immunity, and therefore, even though the court went out of its way to say these people were clearly guilty and clearly directed this criminal enterprise, nevertheless, because of their technical diplomatic immunity, they could not be sentenced for the crimes they committed.
A CIA station chief gets diplomatic immunity?
And the prosecutors in this case are taking an appeal of that. They take the view that that this person obviously was the CIA station chief. He was operating under diplomatic cover, so he had a position nominally as a minister counselor in the U.S. embassy in Rome, and he had what they call agrément, so he'd been formally listed with the Italian foreign ministry. So that's the basis of the claim of immunity. But the prosecutors take the view that immunity cannot be recognized in the case where a person quite obviously was not ever a diplomat and was engaged in activities that are completely inconsistent with a diplomatic mission, which is clearly the case here. And I'll tell you, I've talked to several people in the U.S. State Department and the Justice Department about this, and they're telling me that they think actually there are not a few people in the United States, in the U.S. government, who believe that the prosecutors in Italy will likely prevail in this argument and overturn the diplomatic immunity because it's a very, very vulnerable claim, very suspect claim.
Well, it seems to me, you know, one of the problems with the U.S. engaging in rendition and torture is it exposes other U.S. citizens and soldiers and diplomats to greater risks because people are going to think it's okay to do whatever the U.S. has done. And in this case, it sounds like it could put diplomats at risk because other nations could say, we don't accept your claim of diplomatic immunity because we think you're a spy, and look what you did in Italy where you so obviously used a spy. This policy could put real diplomats, legitimate diplomats, at risk in other countries, don't you think?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, well, this is the karma that the U.S. is putting out there all across the planet. So this is something that that started under the watch of George Bush, but it continued under Obama, didn't it? And they're maintaining all the claims and all the protections that Bush started, aren't they?
Well, Obama's posture is not simple to describe, but let me give it a go. I mean, basically, he shut down the extraordinary renditions program that the Bush era had. He ordered the cessation and termination of all the black sites. He ordered that there would be no more cooperation with foreign intelligence agencies in these torture interrogation sessions. So those are significant differences. He, however, left the door open for what we would call traditional renditions of the sort that occurred under Clinton and Bush 41. But the most important thing here is that Obama has kept the door firmly closed on any attempts to investigate what went on in the past or to have any criminal accountability for people who ran this system. And I think this case in Italy helps us understand why he's doing that. The more information comes out, the more likely the people who are involved will be prosecuted. It's not a question of them being prosecuted in the United States. Of course, most of these things went on overseas. It's the countries overseas bringing criminal charges against them. And in fact, in this case, in Italy, the chief prosecutor, Armando Spataro, has made clear repeatedly programs he would be prosecuted and almost certainly would wind up being convicted on these kidnapping and assault charges. In fact, the prosecutor has also made clear what sentence he would seek, which is 13 years.
13 years. We are in a strange time here where it appears that the Obama administration is protecting pretty much all of the violations of the law and the Constitution that the Bush administration engaged in. Have there been any examples at all of any efforts to identify illegal activity and apply justice to it that the Obama administration has engaged in? Any?
Well, no. The only thing that's happened is the Attorney General's appointment of John Durham, who's a career prosecutor from Connecticut, to investigate these 10 cases that were identified by the CIA's inspector general, which involved homicides connected with torture. And he's requested that he do a preliminary examination, which I think most people think may very well not turn into a formal criminal prosecution. But that's the only thing that's happened. And otherwise, what the administration has done is withhold evidence, make representations to courts denying that there was wrongdoing when we know that, of course, it happened. And in litigation all across the United States, very aggressively invoked the state secrets doctrine. Now, during the campaign, both Obama and Joe Biden gave speeches in which they said that the Bush administration's unprecedented invocation of the state secrets doctrine was abusive, and they were going to stop this. But since they've come to office, they have continued straight line, exactly the same invocations, exactly the same way the Bush administration did. So there's been no change. So that's one promise definitely not kept. In fact, the New York Times pointed this out in a major editorial recently.
I've been very interested in the Justice Department's current status. I had a chance to get together with Cyril Wecht and Don Siegelman back in August. They have been victims of horrific cases of prosecutorial abuse by Bush-appointed, Rove-directed attorneys in the Justice Department. And those attorneys are still there. And apparently Obama and his Attorney General, Eric Holder, have done just about nothing to clear out this wasp's nest of prosecutors who have engaged in horrible partisan, I believe, criminal acts.
It's worse than nothing, I would say. In the Siegelman case, we actually had a member of the prosecution team come forward and acknowledge what Siegelman claimed was true. That is, you know, he was a political target. They did use evidence in the trial that they knew was bogus, and they did cajole or improperly influence a witness to give bad testimony. When that whistleblower came forward, she, and I've interviewed her down in Alabama at some length, she was the subject of an absolutely vicious vendetta brought by the Justice Department to shut her up and intimidate her. And this was done at a time when she was being interviewed by the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee. So what the Justice Department was doing was actually obstruction of a congressional investigation, which is a crime, in fact, it's a felony. But they did it, and they did it to intimidate her. And then they fired her, which is a violation of the Whistleblower Protection Act. I subsequently interviewed another.
Was that done by the Obama administration or by the Bush administration?
It was started during the Bush administration, but it continued, and the final decision to fire her occurred after Obama came in. So Eric Holder did nothing to stop what was put in chain by his predecessor. And I subsequently have interviewed another member of the prosecution team who told me that he was in a position, again, to corroborate these allegations of wrongdoing by their team. In fact, he says he knows that that the chief prosecutor managing the case gave instructions to FBI agents to suppress evidence. He went on and detailed a whole series of things that he personally witnessed. But he tells me he knows if he comes forward and talks about this, he will be a target of exactly the same vicious vendetta that this other whistleblower was a target of. And he says, and he knows, even though things have changed and Obama's in power, it won't change things one iota. They'll be just as they were before because the Justice Department is determined to cover up all of its prior bad acts. They don't want, they really don't want to overturn the case. They want to hold on to it. And Laura Canary, who is a close confidant of Karl Rove's, continues to be the U.S. attorney in the Middle District of Alabama. We're now, you know, a year after the election. She's still there, still running that office, and still engaged in highly abusive conduct there.
How does this fit into the history of the Justice Department and the Attorney General? What, has this historically been the case that things like this happen?
Well, I'm convinced that this is the saddest chapter in the entire history of the Justice Department right now, certainly over the last 8 years. I mean, American history hardly knows episodes that are as terrible as this that involve such political abuse of the powers of the Justice Department. But if we look for a historical precedent, the only one can really be found between 1798 and 1801. Which is a period which was known as the Reign of Witches by Thomas Jefferson, and that's when the High Federalists were running the government, and they used the Justice Department and the Attorney General's powers to go after leading figures of the Democratic Party, what was then known as the Democratic-Republican Party, and they prosecuted congressmen and a number of other officials, newspaper editors, and so forth, using the Alien and Sedition Acts.
That's
the only historical precedent for this. And, of course, when Thomas Jefferson came in, he directed prosecutions be opened into the prosecutors who did this, and some of them were prosecuted, in fact.
My impression of this is that the failure of Eric Holder to do anything about this at this point makes him worse than his predecessor, Gonzalez. What's your take on Holder?
To me, it's puzzling that he's so weak in dealing with all these things. But I believe that Holder's attitude is that above all else, he wants to avoid embarrassment of the Justice Department as an institution. And that's the reason why he refuses to, he's continuing, in fact, the cover-up of some of this misconduct. The only case he acted on was the one involving Senator Stevens. And I think he did that basically because the federal judge handling the case, Emmett Sullivan, flagged all these things, made determinations, and he, in fact, acted on them. So, you know, basically, Holder had no option in that case but to take some steps.
So you're saying that Holder is intentionally engaging in a cover-up?
I think that he is certainly taking no steps to clean the situation, to clean house. In terms of internal investigations, there still hasn't been a serious internal investigation of the Justice Department. All that happened is to sweep serious bad acts into the carpet over and over again.
Now, it's really something that it doesn't stop with Holder. This is something that hasn't it been the tradition of presidents that they ask for their resignations and they replace these attorneys, or at least a good chunk of the politically appointed ones?
Normally, U.S. attorneys automatically turn in their resignations at the end of a president's term, and at the beginning of a new one, new U.S. attorneys are appointed. But of course, you just cited two worst of all the U.S. attorneys, Laura Canary and Mary Beth Buchanan, people who were most deeply involved in political prosecutions. They refused to submit their resignations, and they're still in office.
So they refused. I wasn't aware that they had refused. Is there recourse for Holder or Obama? Can they fire them?
Well, of course, he can appoint new people and send the appointments to the Senate, and they can be confirmed, and they can be ousted that way.
So in order to get rid of those two prosecutors, it has to go through the Senate. They can't remove them and then replace them later?
No, they can. They can press for their resignations, or the president can just issue an order firing them.
So he doesn't have to go through the Senate to fire them?
No. He has to go through the Senate to appoint the replacement.
It seems to me like this country would be better off having nobody there instead of having them there.
But you would have a career professional serve in an interim capacity. That's what would happen.
So that would probably be the way Bush used the opportunity to put in political people on occasion, on temporary replacement basis.
Well, that's right. He secured, in fact, a modification of the appointment structure in the USA Patriot Act that he was able to use.
All right, we're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but let me just give a brief station. This is Rob Call, Bottom Up Radio, WNJC 1360 AM. We're talking with Scott Horton, an attorney who writes for Harper's. Scott, let's wrap up. What do you see coming up before the end of the year in terms of any other legal developments in the world of torture or the judicial system that is going to make news or that could make news or that should make news?
The next major development will be the release of the OPR report, which is the Internal Justice Department investigation of the work of the torture lawyers. And that has, in fact, been ready for half a year already, more than half a year, and Eric Holder's been holding it up. But I know that Senator Whitehouse and others in Congress have been pressing him very strongly to release this document, and I'm hearing now that this is likely to be released in the next several weeks. And I think that's going to make a lot of waves. And then after that, Dianne Feinstein's Intelligence Committee has done its investigation of CIA programs relating to torture, and that's going to be released early next year. So those are the two next major points.
Any expectations of what will come out of either of those reports?
The OPR report, I'm told, will contain very, very explosive information that's going to show that Vice President Dick Cheney and his staff were deeply enmeshed from the beginning in the entire torture project and, in fact, were leading it. I'm told that we're going to see that as these torture opinions were being prepared, there was constant communication going back and forth with the Vice President's office, and he was, and he and his staffers were approving and, in fact, suggesting the text of these opinions. So I think that's going to be the major headline. So it's, in a sense, it's no surprise that Vice President Dick Cheney has been the forward person defending Bush administration policy, and particularly policies concerning torture, because he's the author of those policies.
Right. The do you think it'll lead to any actions on the part of the Justice Department or the Congress, or should it?
Well, I think that when this comes out, it'll be much more difficult for John Durham, the special prosecutor, to say he's not going to conduct any criminal investigation, and two, it'll be much more difficult for him to avoid looking at the role that was played by the Justice Department lawyers in this process. I think he's going to be under a lot of pressure to do that.
Now, this has been delayed. It's finished. It's been held up for 6 months already. Do you think that the efforts by the Obama administration to get the health care bill passed are perhaps delaying the release of this because they want to keep things focused? Or do you have any questions?
Yes, I'm quite sure that's the case. I think yeah. Two things. They want the focus of public attention to be on the health care debate, one. And two, they do not want anything to occur that will put pressure on John Durham to just walk away or conclude that there's no need for a criminal investigation. Of course, this OPR report would greatly complicate things.
It seems to me that there's some horror stories here, and yet the American people are failing to respond. Let's take a step back to the Italian convictions. You're a high-profile media person. Has the mainstream media picked up on this much? Have you been talking to the mainstream media much?
Well, yeah, I've talked to people at certainly at both NBC and CBS about it, and there was an initial interest, but, you know, it didn't make the cut for inclusion in the evening news or in any of the special programs yet. But I think in due course we're going to see some stories about it, yes.
So basically they've background had contact with you or maybe even done an interview but not broadcast it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, Brian Ross did a story which was quite significant on ABC News, but NBC and CBS have not yet done anything, but I think there may well be, yes.
Well, it'd be nice to see that. All right, this has been great. So it's been great to have you here. I hope we can have you back. Do you ever get a look at Op-Ed News, by the way?
All right, Carol, you can cut. We'll go to
regularly.
Do you? That's great.
Okay, so this is Rob Call back. We're live now with Congressman Joe Sestak. You've had a busy day today. I've seen you all over the stations. Thanks so much for coming onto the show here.
Absolutely, Rob, and happy Veterans Day.
Thank you, and happy Veterans Day to you. And boy, you've had a history of working with veterans. You led 15,000 sailors, 30 ships, 100 aircraft. You're an admiral. You've had quite a career serving the people of the United States.
Well, I very much enjoyed it, but I have to tell you something. As I left the service with my daughter having a malignant brain tumor at the age of 4, I was able to take care of her because of the medical health care program we have in the military. So I got into politics to pay back. I have a personal debt I owe this nation because although I did serve it for over 3 decades in the military, at that one moment when I most needed help, this nation was there, and so I need to pay it back. And that's why I'm in politics and ran for Congress and also am running for the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania now, because There's a lot to be done to pay this nation back.
Well, you know, I'm really pleased that we had a chance to talk here. You know, we've met on a couple different occasions at the Constitution Center very briefly during the last debate and then at the Netroots in Pittsburgh. But here you are, you're running against Arlen Specter, hoping to run against Pat Toomey. And I'm hoping to, in this conversation today to let our listeners and the readers at opednews.com as well get an idea of who you are and what you stand for. I kind of got a debriefing from Chris Bowers, by the way, who I respect very highly as a progressive pioneer of the blogosphere. And he speaks highly of you, and that meant a lot to me, and I'm sure it'll also to our listeners and readers as well. But would you call yourself a progressive?
Without a question, and here's why. From what I learned in the U.S. military, that if you invest in your people, the dividends that are rewarded to this nation are tremendous. I went off for 11 and a half months of a war, yet my wife, my daughter, were provided health care. Everyone had health care in the military. Education, we won't promote you to certain ranks until you achieve educational level, our dime, but your time. And third, economic opportunity. Come on in and be all you can be. We'll give you a trade, and you can be all that you desire. And then we have pensions. And so I somehow, when I got out of the military, landed, thought of myself as a pragmatic person and found out I was landed smack dab into the progressive movement. And that's one where I honestly believe also stands for those wonderful values that mark progress. And that's freedom. That's civil rights. That's suffrage. That's equality. And so values are the marks of a progressive.
Are you a member of the Progressive Caucus?
No, I'm not a member of the Progressive Caucus. At the time, I was not, because the Progressive Caucus at that moment down there was one where I had initially gone down and said I'd join one caucus for the first 4 to 5 or so months, which was the Asian Pacific Caucus, because I have a very wonderful immigrant part of my district that are Asian Pacific, particularly Southwest Asia, and I told them that I would only be on that. And then the Progressive Caucus, I just never got that. Geez, you know, until you brought it up, I've never even thought about it, and I probably should. I mean, my record is from GLBT issues right down the line is that, but I haven't been, and I should probably.
That'd be great. Yeah, one of the issues that is dear to my heart and the heart of our readers, we've probably got over 1,000 articles on it, is single payer. And from what I understand, you don't support single payer because and I'd like to hear a little bit about where you stand on that.
Without a question. It's not that I'm opposed to single payer if we were eventually to find out that what we are presently doing in Congress were not to work. I say that because there's three reasons primarily that I believe that if you can get a fair competition with transparency providing that fairness, that you can ultimately best discipline costs. In the U.S. Navy, for example, when I watched as this Navy of ours, as our military does, are in a sense single procurers. And I watched a destroyer say that told everyone it was going to cost $1 billion. It ended up, until we canceled it out of my committee in the House of Representatives, $5.5 billion, because there was no discipline via competition on the cost of it. Second, I was very, very taken by the very good aspects of single payer or hybrids thereof that we see in England or Canada, but I also recognize that we tend to subsidize those single payer systems, as the Government Accounting Office and others have done studies that show that those countries buy their drugs from America for on average 1/3 the cost that we pay because of the laws that permit our pharmaceuticals to sell drugs over there, but we cannot re-import them, as we're trying to change. And so my take on each of these is that there are good aspects of single payer, but if you're able to affect fair, good competition that rewards entrepreneurship, ultimately you not only best discipline costs, but you get administration. I don't dismiss that there are good things in single payer, like lower administrative costs, but that's why the public option, if we don't have that, you do not get the health care reform that gets to what I want to get to. And so without that, then you have to sit back and say, well, then you've got to think deeply about single payer. Because without that fair competition, 94% of all health insurance markets in America, according to the Department of Justice criteria, are non-competitive pricing. In Pennsylvania, two companies have 70% of all health care plans, and they dictate the prices. That's why the public option gets us to where we need to, if it works out, a fair competition.
No, it's a beginning, but, you know, two things you made me think of. One is I'm an entrepreneur. I have two businesses and I run a nonprofit, and it's hard to compare entrepreneurship at the level I'm at, which is small business, to you characterize entrepreneurship in healthcare insurance, where you've got these $100 billion companies. That's not exactly entrepreneurial anymore. That's awful big top-down, too big to fail kind of businesses. The earlier interview I did was with Bernie Sanders and his new legislation about identifying and breaking up those industries, those companies that are too big to fail.
You're absolutely right.
And the other thing is, we started this interview with you talking about your experience with military health care, and that's single payer.
Actually, it is a hybrid form of it. As you all know, it's run by a private company, and we pay co-pays and premiums into it. It is overseen by the U.S. government on that, so it's kind of a hybrid of it. But we also have, like, Medicare, which is single payer. And I think it's a good system. We need to change it from fee-for-service solely to preventive care. But as you know, it goes bankrupt in 2017. And so we are going to extend that to 2022 in this new health care reform bill. But you're right. When you talk, and the problem is, but these are big corporations. I don't want to keep entrepreneurship with them. Right now, small new insurance companies can't get into the marketplace, can't be more entrepreneurial or offer more premiums because there are antitrust laws that protect large insurance companies in the health business. We do lower those aspects in this bill that begins to get it. I'm also talking about the pharmaceutical industry also and how we go about making sure that they don't garner, as they've done, undue legislative protection that the Bush administration gave them, where we aren't able to compete, to have them compete for via Medicare for competitive pricing. They can dictate the prices there. But we will also then help them be not killing the goose, but trying to get them to not do undue profits. And that type of entrepreneurship is also one I'm worried about because in the case of my daughter, as the doctor said, Joe, this is the same brain tumor, very malignant, and as I just told you, the same as Ed Kennedy has. If we can get her down the road 5 years, there'll be a new type of drug out there that can get her another 5 for sure. And so keeping that entrepreneurship is important also in this bill.
Absolutely. Well, let's move into another aspect of health, and that's the vets who are undergoing an incredible percentage of them experiencing either post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. From what I understand, the number of psychiatrists and psychologists who are dealing with this in the military is just maybe 1 per 1,000 soldiers, and Iraq Veterans Against the War submitted something to President Obama when he was down at Fort Hood, asking for some changes, like things that would normalize getting help and making it so that the military would reach out to vets to help them rather than them having to ask for help. What do you think about these ideas?
Oh, I think you are spot on. I mean, today I spent time with vets that were incarcerated in the state custodial institution in Chester City. They were there. Two of them took burnt off. They did have post-traumatic stress disorder. They became dependent upon alcohol and drugs. There was no care from the VA. They didn't know about programs. A couple of Iraq vets, Gulf War, and one later. Vietnam vets. And that addiction led to homelessness and crime, and they're incarcerated for years. And I wanted to see, how do we break this cycle? Because we have over 30% of our troops coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder from Iraq and Afghanistan or other mental challenges. And yet, when the National Guard comes home, they fill out a self-referral form. Do you feel suicidal? Wait a moment. If we had 30% of our soldiers coming home with a kidney disease, we would be having them sit down with a kidney disease specialist. Now, the problem is we need to do that in confidence, because 3 out of every 4 soldiers feels as though their career would be harmed if they admitted they had a mental challenge. It's still a cause of disease, unfortunately. But we could do things in better confidence. And to your numbers, there used to be in 2005 1 behavioral or mental health expert in Iraq for every 350 soldiers. Now it's 1 for every 750. This signature issue of the war, post-traumatic stress disorder combined with traumatic brain injury, is one of the gravest harms that society is going to have to deal with because of this war. It's not that they're a weaker generation. They're as strong as not stronger. They go outside the wire every day into a combat-like situation for 15 months, come home for 12, go back for 15 more. It's unremitting pressure on them. In World War II, our heroes in that war saw the most horrific battles, but there was dwell time in between the battles because they averaged during the war about 182 days of combat. So the nerves and the mental state could get prepared for the next onslaught. If there's anywhere we have to do more, and since I've been down there, we've appropriated $10 billion for this, but how well is that money being done? Are we getting the right types of neuroscience research? Are we getting the right types of doctors out there for our vets and our active duty? So this is important.
Talking to neuroscience, for 15 years I ran conferences on brainwave biofeedback, and from what I understand, the military is beginning to use brainwave training, teaching them how to control their brains to deal with the PTSD. Have you heard anything about that?
I have heard about it, but I don't know more than just what you just said. And the reason is I've tried to have an amendment in this last defense bill that the Senate took out. That's why I've got to get to the Senate. And it said NIH is putting billions into neuroscience research. Let's have them merge their research, or at least collaborate on it, with the $10 billion we've allocated to the Veterans Department and the Defense Department, and it got taken out. But I heard about this research while I was doing that amendment.
Now, if you'd like, I can get more information to you on it.
I would be tremendous. Tremendous.
Okay, the next thing I want to talk to you about is, You were involved in the Navy's anti-terrorism unit. You were apparently the first director of Deep Blue, and now we're facing a situation where we're looking at reactivating or maintaining the Patriot Act. We're looking at FISA and rendition and torture. I just had Scott Horton on talking about the CIA agents who were convicted in Italy of engaging in rendition. What's your take on the use of rendition and torture?
I think there should never be torture. How can we wreck our ideals and say we're defending them? We should close Gitmo. I had a bill 2 years ago that said habeas corpus should be in any prison we have, not just Gitmo, but around the world. And any only prison like Gitmo that creates more terrorists outside its walls than we can hold inside, we should close. I'm so disappointed Democrats didn't stand up for that.